The South African Reserve Bank was founded today exactly 100 years ago, and in wishing the Saab happy birthday on this special occasion, the nation and the Saab have many reasons to be proud of the role that the bank has played in the economy over the past century. On the long view, it has been a vital anchor in South Africa in often rough political seas over the past 100 years of South Africa's economic history. In this period, it's built up an excellent reputation for professionalism, integrity and credibility, which still stand it in good stead as South Africa battles with its latest economic challenges. The Saab has for 100 years been a major pillar for financial stability in this country, and in truth and in error, it has nonetheless been a bastion of professionalism in South African policy making too. But first, a bit of history. Apart from the central banks already long established in countries like England, France, the Netherlands and Germany, most other countries had not created such key banking institutions by World War I. However, immediately after the First World War, the International Financial Conference held in Brussels passed a resolution saying that all countries that had not yet established a central bank should do so as soon as possible to restore global financial stability. Over the next few decades, commencing with the establishment of the Saab in 1921, there was great activity in the formation of central banks in the newly created states of Europe and in countries in the so-called New World. Although the Saab's present autonomy formally stems from the current constitution, right from the outset, being broadly modelled on the Bank of England, it was widely perceived as being at arm's length from politics. The Saab is also self-financing and doesn't depend on government financing. And as Raymond Parsons mentioned on the programme last week, the Saab's origin had a tangential interaction with the great British economist John Maynard Keynes. In 1921, Jan Smuts asked him to chair a selection committee in London to choose the first governor of South Africa's fledgling central bank, William Clegg, who served from 1920 to 1931. Clegg was chief cashier of the BOE. There's also been a degree of stability in Saab leadership in that over its 100-year existence, to date, the tenure for governors averages roughly 10 years. Of course, over such a long period, it's inevitable that from time to time some mistakes have been made. Historically, the Saab misread the dynamics around the Great Depression and of South Africa needing to leave the gold standard in the 1930s. And mistakes in monetary policy are inevitable. No central banker should be spare it, and not many are, said economist John Kenneth Galbraith. The checks and balances broadly lie in having an effective monetary policy committee, in bringing good judgment in monetary policy decision-making to bear on very mechanistic economic models, and in transparency, from time to time ensuring a robust debate about any particular Saab decisions that may be challenged. Well, that said, let's welcome our panel to celebrate 100 years of this key institution, Deputy Governor Fundi Chazibana, an economist with extensive experience in public policy analysis and formulation. She's worked for National Treasury, the National Energy Regulator, NERSA and the IMF, Investec Chief Economist Annabel Bishop, and Isa Mplunger, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes. Deputy Governor, 100 years, happy birthday. Your thoughts briefly on the Saab reaching this milestone.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having us. It's quite a momentous occasion for the Saab, not only because of the 100 years of existence, but, you know, as a previously colonized country that was part of the Commonwealth, we've had our own currency for only 61 years. That's a big milestone to celebrate. And something that we take for granted today, which is central bank independence, is only 25 years old. So it's 25 years of central bank independence this year, and also 21 years of inflation targeting. I think that one of the reasons why we celebrate an institution like a central bank getting to 100 years is that for a constitutional democracy, it's important for us to observe how institutions can be utilized to serve the interests of society, how institutions are supposed to be strengthened so that they progress with the economy as the economy grows and evolves. And so to have an institution that has been able to survive 100 years and is still useful for the country in terms of aligning itself with the requirements of the economy, with the development of financial markets, is quite important and something worth celebrating.
And we saw another key institution in the Constitutional Court stand firm yesterday. So our institutional strength has been reaffirmed over the last couple of days. Isa, what are your broad thoughts before we go into some detail around monetary policy as the Saab celebrates this milestone of a centenary?
I think the central bank has served us very well over the last century. I like what one of the deputy governors, Deputy Governor Naidu, characterizes the Saab as. It's the goalkeeper, if you check the analogy of soccer. It always defends when things go bad, but it is not necessarily the one that scores goals, which means all the other policy levers in the economy need to do the heavy lifting of actually scoring the goals, which is, in our context, creating employment. But if you look through the Great Depression, through World War, through some couple of banking crises, the global financial crisis, and much more recently, as we are in currently, the response that they have done through, you know, to help households and firms, that has been one of the most aggressive response they have done. So they have served society well, and they continue to do so.
Annabel, your broad thoughts before we dive into some of the monetary policy detail?
Yes, well, I suppose to talk about something that hasn't been covered in order to agree with the previous two respondents. Look, I think we need to bear in mind as well that the Reserve Bank is key institutional strength, which actually provides a lot of balance in our credit ratings against the deterioration we see from our public finances. I think, you know, that mustn't be forgotten as well. It's outstanding in performance, and I think, you know, the exceptional institutional strength is something which is expected to continue as well. And that's very helpful for us. You know, that in turn talks to financial stability. You know, rapidly losing our credit ratings is not helpful for financial stability. And of course, the Reserve Bank has been highly successful in engendering financial stability, certainly over the past few crises, but of course even further back as well. I think for South Africa, it's paramount that we have had such a strong leadership at the Reserve Bank as we have, you know, transitioned over very, very different periods, you know, both from apartheid into democracy, but of course so as well into different periods in financial markets. And if you look at the period when we started inflation targeting, you know, South Africa did particularly well, coming from very high inflation, bringing it down quite substantially as well. Look, I know that we have had some governance issues at some banks, but in general, bank supervision of South Africa is regarded exceptionally highly internationally, and of course that was obviously really seen in the great financial crisis as well. Remember our 2008-2009 period that many of us have stopped thinking about after COVID last year.
Yep. And in inflation targeting, many countries managed to control inflation without formally Deputy Governor adopting inflation targeting. But as you say, we celebrate 21 years of this as a formal policy since 2000. How successful would you say inflation targeting as a policy has been over the last 21 years?
So, you know, South Africa has had different monetary policy framework. I would say inflation targeting has been the most successful, both in terms of communication, so that it's very clear what it is that the central bank is doing, how the central bank takes its decision, and also in terms of keeping inflation in check. So what we saw in the period immediately after the adoption of inflation targeting, we saw inflation coming down significantly. I mean, we had come from a period of double-digit inflation, and I think that if there was a lot of nervousness about a target that had 3 to 6%, would it ever be possible if you'd come out of a period of inflation north of 15% to have inflation actually come down to 3%, and we have seen that it is possible. What we have also seen since 2016 is that it's also possible for inflation to get below 6%, because we have started to see some structural shifts happening in the economy. So I would say that inflation targeting has been successful. It doesn't mean, of course, that everything is perfect, because as much as we have inflation targeting where the central bank, through its action, aims to keep inflation down, the price structure of the economy also matters. And as Isaiah highlighted earlier, for for change to happen in the economy, it's not only the role of the central bank. So over the last few years, we have seen the Competition Commission do a number of studies looking at what are the things that are driving prices in some sectors, what is it that makes prices very sticky. They did the bread study that came up with some profound findings in terms of what happens in the value chain and about bringing down the cost structure of the economy and having affordable prices overall.
Absolutely. And Isaac, just to move over on inflation targeting, a commendable job for the longest time we had this runaway inflation. We've now brought inflation since 2016 to within this band of 3 to 6%. Is it time to maybe start thinking about having a single point? And often the Reserve Bank speaks of 4.5% and anchoring expectations around that particular number. Or is the band of 3 to 6% still appropriate given our current context?
Look, I think the central bank more often communicates that our trading partners have lower inflation targets. I think the deputy governor will be more placed to give you a more solid response on this. But generally, we become more competitive if we are in line with our trading partners, and we are still slightly above. But if you just look how they have messaged their inflation targeting framework over the last 2017, at least, to say they would prefer the inflation expectations to be anchored around 4.5%. That is almost implicitly moving to a point target, though within the framework they still have a band of 1.5 on either side.
Annabel, I want to get your thoughts on this, because in recent times ASAR has aimed at getting and keeping inflation at this midpoint, at 4.5%, and it could be argued that it deviates from the flexibility that a 3 to 6% range has. So shouldn't we just move to a single target of 4.5%?
Well, I suppose maybe just to have a look at your question right at the start as well. You know, if you look at our inflation target of 3 to 6%, I'm actually anticipating we're probably eventually going to move maybe to a 3 to 5% target, and I'll tell you why. But I do think that, you know, if you have a look at our key trading partners, as I so ably mentioned, you know, their inflation rates tend to be close to 3%, if not 2%. And, of course, you know, working down our inflation is very helpful, you know, both from a certainty perspective as well, because the higher inflation you get does actually put some uncertainty in the system, but also, of course, as well, to protect the value of money, it actually makes the financial system more stable. It's difficult to do when your government finances are in a perilous state as we are in, and perhaps we could argue that now is not the time. But we are also on a trajectory to improve our government finances quite significantly as well. So your question, is it better to have a point than a target? I think a target's easier to explain, because inflation is quite volatile in South Africa. And I'd caution here that a very key component of inflation is food price inflation. And we can't do anything about that. You know, the weather is not something we can control. And increasingly, it's going to become more volatile as we move into deeper periods of climate change as well. So that's why it's helpful to have an inflation target band, because, you know, the reality of the situation is we have had double-digit inflation before, and fairly recently as well, when we moved into very substantial drought periods. Now, if we're going to go into double-digit inflation again, and then we see interest rate hikes because it starts to expect to become entrenched, that's on the positive side of having an inflation band. But of course, and there are many other examples as well, but of course, looking at a target does bring more certainty to the system, and ultimately, you know, and it's hard to do an emerging market economy. We've done particularly well, but ultimately we probably want to bring our inflation rate down to 2 to 3%, and that's when a point becomes much more useful, because then you really are targeting inflation at that level.
Right. Deputy Governor, what are your thoughts inside the Reserve Bank when you sit and discuss these issues, which I'm sure you do?
Yeah, so the first objective that we had when we decided to communicate a lot more clearly that we would like to see inflation closer to the midpoint of the inflation target is that we were worried that as much as we had an inflation target band that was 3 to 6%, our inflation was very sticky on the upper end of the band. And that presents challenges when you have a crisis. That meant that when we speak about the flexibility that we have within the target, we are talking about inflation north of 6%. So both Isaiah and Annabelle mentioned the fact that our trading partners have inflation that is significantly lower than ours. So probably in the early 2000s, we saw our trading partners having inflation of between 4 and 3%. It's now moved down to between 3 and 2%. So that's a very important component for us. I think what is important for a country such as ours is to start to see inflation stabilizing within the inflation target band. Obviously, lower inflation is better for us, but we want to see inflation expectations at least starting to anchor lower. And this is what we have seen over the last 3 years. We have seen inflation expectations coming down from being sticky at the upper end of the band, coming closer to the midpoint of the inflation target. Mm. Of course, we want the target to be lower, and that is a conversation that the governor could have with the Minister of Finance. It is not happening currently, but certainly something that is important for us to consider in the period ahead. Clearly, when you're in the crisis, it's not the time to be having a conversation about a lower inflation target, but we are starting to see some significant shifts in prices that were previously sticky. Services prices have come down in the economy, which is a positive sign. We've started to see the prices of for communications coming down, which is a significant milestone for us. As I mentioned earlier, it's important that we see other complementary steps that are being taken by government to assist in bringing prices down in the economy in order to assist the Reserve Bank in its consideration of a lower inflation target as well.
As Isa said, government playing more of that striker role while the Reserve Bank plays that of the goalkeeper, as I'm sure we're all watching the Euros and being thoroughly entertained at the moment with the football. The IMF Deputy Governor recently stated that the mandate of monetary policy should include macroeconomic stability and not just price stability. And I think it's within the broader context of the response, and you mentioned the crisis, that we've seen central banks around the world using this language of doing whatever it takes. And I know some of the critics of the Reserve Bank have said, well, perhaps the bank has been too narrowly focused on inflation and should be looking at macroeconomic stability as well. How do you debate this inside the bank and around the MPC table?
Yeah, so macroeconomic stability is very important for any country. I would say it is the cornerstone of economic growth. So yes, you need other things to happen for an economy to grow. You need investment to increase. You need there to be employment. You need your productivity to be higher. But none of those things are sustainable if there is no macroeconomic stability. And this is an area that the Reserve Bank and the National Treasury have got collective responsibility for, and that includes ensuring that our policy levers and our tools support macroeconomic stability, and that would include looking at what is happening in terms of the fiscal numbers, what is happening in terms of monetary policy. Is the monetary policy stance appropriate to support growth in the economy? At the moment, the monetary policy stance is highly accommodative, we believe. If we look at our other levers and tools as well, we have taken steps as the Reserve Bank to also make some relaxations in the banking sector regulations in order to allow the banks to on-lend to consumers, and that means that the credit conditions are also conducive in order to support investments. So those elements are very important to bring together. And another element of macroeconomic stability, of course, is looking at how a country is taxing its citizens, because you don't want to have a taxation model that sort of erodes the benefits to consumers. So if the taxes are too high, that will have some impact on demand in the economy. So you basically are shifting, or you're reducing the amount of disposable income that is available to households to spend in the economy. So these are things that the Reserve Bank and the Treasury discuss on an ongoing basis, and we compare notes on these issues. However, I think that in terms of our mandate, we focus primarily on price stability. We coordinate and we liaise with the Treasury, of course, on issues on broader macro stability. We focus on price stability. We ensure that markets continue to function appropriately. We regulate banks as provided for in legislation. And we ensure that the financial system overall is stable.
And just on the issue of the debates that you have inside the central bank, we know some central banks publish their minutes of the MPC. The FOMC minutes are always a highlight whenever they're published in markets during that week. Is this something that potentially the bank could consider doing in future, publishing the minutes of these discussions?
Yeah, so the statement that the governor reads is probably as close as we will get to the minutes of the discussions. And the discussions are at a fairly, you know, they're very dense. That if we were to say to you, here are the minutes of the MPC, it would actually be a book. But what we try to do in the statement is to give you a sense of the issues that were discussed in the meeting itself. We don't want to focus too much in having a set of minutes. If the minutes are going to then prevent us in the discussions that we're having, instead of saying, oh, we're going to have a set of minutes for this part of the meeting, and it constrains the robustness of the discussion, you will see that also other central banks publish the voting patterns in the MPC, who has voted in which direction. We don't publish that as a SARB. We simply tell you what the votes were. We don't tell you who voted in which way, because we want to focus the attention on the decisions made rather than on who said what, because we don't think that that is the most important element of our communication.
I'm going to throw it out to the two economists as well on the panel as to whether or not they'd like to see minutes and would like some extra bedtime reading in the form of a book of minutes at every single meeting. Isaac, what do you think?
I think it would be, you know, interesting to get us a more granular, you know, understanding of the discussions that take place. You know, there are other aspects that other central banks are discussing currently, which we are not aware whether the SARB is actively discussing. For instance, the issue of inequality, you know, as far as monetary policy is concerned, it does have distributional impact, both on an income point of view and on a wealth point of view. So to what extent is that a phenomenon in South Africa, given that we do have an extreme level of inequality globally? Is the central bank, for instance, discussing such? We don't know. If we had minutes, we would find such things.
Annabelle, are you looking for some extra bedtime reading?
Definitely not a book, no. Perhaps a short pamphlet. Look, I think, you know, what's interesting about the FOMC minutes is they do go into quite a bit more detail on a number of factors in there. And, you know, it perhaps does provide a bit more grist to the mill. That said, I do find the MPC statement very comprehensive, you know. So for me, I do find it sufficient, but perhaps sometimes when there's a switch in monetary policy, and particularly when there's an unanticipated switch in monetary policy, that's when I think we feel the lack of minutes. You know, we feel the lack of being able to drill down to something which perhaps would have given us more of a sense. But of course, we do need to bear in mind that we're an emerging market economy. We're not an advanced economy like the United States or the UK, and therefore we do have a lot more volatility. And we also, you know, tend to change direction quite quickly as well. Whereas, you know, large economies like the US and the UK that I mentioned, you know, they have the stability, and it's easier to signal a longer term trend. So I think, you know, in South Africa, our Reserve Bank probably does battle a bit, you know, trying to find a path where we do see factors change so very rapidly in the markets. And bear in mind as well that, you know, the impact of the currency, the impact of interest rates has an impact on the currency, but of course, you know, in turn, the currency on inflation again. And as a consequence of this, you know, it can also sometimes create volatility in the markets, and therefore for the currency, if, you know, if perhaps there is too much uncertainty. And I think that's where the Reserve Bank provides a balance, provides a MPC statement which, you know, gives enough certainty but doesn't add too much extra in again. So it's a difficult debate. You know, we're not, as I said, an advanced economy.
With a minute to go, Deputy Governor, is the MPC not supposed to have 7 members? I know often when I chat to Professor Raymond Parsons about this, he always says, and he sat on the board for a while, that it should have 7 members and not 5. Why are we not up to full strength, or is that a misunderstanding, the way the law is drafted?
Yeah, so the MPC is supposed to have a minimum of 4 members, and the 4 members will be the governor and the 3 deputy governors. The other members of the MPC are, of course, staff that we have at the central bank, and, of course, we utilize the discretion to join the MPC at the time. Easy process in finding MPC members, because these are supposed to be people who are in full-time employment at the SARB. Now, very quickly, I can't leave this debate without mentioning other important areas of work that the SARB is doing. Can't please allow me to just highlight that, you know, as we are celebrating this 100 years, it's very important for us to think about the future and what does the next 100 years potentially look like. And in this regard, the SARB has to be forward-looking, of course, not only in terms of monetary policy, but we have to think about other types of work that we're doing that are important for the economy. What are we going to do to adapt to new financial technologies? How are we going to support our financial surveillance work going forward? How are we going to enhance our payment systems so that they set up for the economy of the future? And that also includes doing some work and understanding how central bank digital currencies are evolving and how that might affect monetary policy as well. So I just thought I should add that as well. That
I wish we had a full hour.
Work that we're doing in the bank.
Deputy Governor,
you have to invite me back for that.
We'll definitely have you back on. And we know the Chinese and the digital yuan, I mean, they've certainly taken the lead globally around central banks adopting and looking at digital currencies. It's a fascinating 100 years that lie ahead, no doubt, and it's been really interesting having you on the panel, sharing some insights into the kinds of thinking and discussions that you have around the MPC as well. Thank you very much, Deputy Governor Fundi Chazibana, Investec Chief Economist Annabel Bishop, and Izan Flunger, Chief Economist at Alexander Forbes. Here's wishing the SARB another 100 years free of political interference.